Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're zeroing in on a really foundational paper. It's all about the asymptotic behavior of complex matrices. We're looking at Craig A. Tracy and Harold Windham's On the Limit of Some Toeplitz-like Determinants. So get ready to sort of unravel how these elegant mathematical tools can, well, predict the destiny of really vast systems.
It's a great paper, and it really offers a shortcut, you could say.
A shortcut. How so?
Well, a shortcut to understanding how these complex matrices behave when they get, you know, really large, their asymptotic behavior.
Okay. We've got quite a journey ahead then. Exploring how this advanced math helps us understand these large systems, we'll need to unpack what Toeplitz-like actually means.
Right. And how different approaches, quite different mathematically, can actually arrive at the same conclusion.
Which is fascinating in itself, and maybe why these formulas are just so powerful, yeah.
Exactly. The work seems rooted in, well, pure mathematics, maybe. But it has these implications. We'll see how two very distinct methods, one using representation theory, the other using what you might call classical Toeplitz theory, they confirm the same underlying truth.
Just expressed differently.
Precisely. Mm. Different conceptual lenses, but the same reality. It shows how robust these mathematical ideas are, you know, that the deep truths have to be consistent.
Okay, let's unpack that central term then. The paper focuses on Toeplitz-like determinants. Now, for those of us listening who, you know, appreciate mathematical structures but maybe don't live and breathe matrices every day, can you give us a quick sense of what a standard Toeplitz matrix is?
Absolutely. So a Toeplitz matrix, often written as TFIST, it's defined by its entries, right? Mm-hmm. They're usually written as C subscript I minus J. The key thing, the defining feature, is that the entries are constant along each diagonal. You look down a diagonal, it's the same number all the way.
Okay, constant diagonal.
Yeah. And these psi values, they're typically the Fourier coefficients of some function. Let's call it phi. Think of them as the amplitudes of different frequency components making up that function.
Well, okay. Like breaking a signal down.
Exactly. And this structure, this constant diagonal thing, makes them fundamental in loads of areas. Signal processing, statistical mechanics, anywhere. You have systems with a kind of shift in variance. Hmm. They model repetitive patterns really well.
Okay. Got it. So if that's the standard Toeplitz matrix, what's the subtle difference? What makes the matrices in this paper Toeplitz-like? What's that like doing there?
Right. So the matrices M that Tracy and Windham look at, their entries are C subscript pi minus QJ. So the indices aren't simply I and J.
Ah, pi and QJ.
Okay. Yeah. And the Toeplitz-like part comes from these sequences, pi and QJ.
Sure.
The key is that for large enough I say, once I is bigger than some number M, we just have pi I and KJ I.
So they start off perhaps differently, but eventually they just become standard indices.
Exactly. So after the first M indices, they behave like a standard Toeplitz matrix. This means they are what we call finite rank perturbations of standard Toeplitz matrices.
Finite rank perturbations. Can you maybe give us an analogy for that?
Sure. Think of it like a huge, perfectly regular crystal lattice, right? That's your Toeplitz matrix. But then, maybe near one edge, there are a few atoms out of place, a few defects, just a finite number. That's the perturbation. The Toeplitz-like matrix is the whole thing mostly regular, but with these localized imperfections.
Okay, so it's like a mostly standard Toeplitz matrix with a few tweaks near the beginning.
That's a good way to put it. These tweaks model real things, too. Imperfections in materials, specific noise patterns and signals, maybe even like a localized shock in a financial model. Understanding how these behave asymptotically lets us predict system performance even with these small disruptions, which is vital because purely ideal models often miss this.
Right, and you also mentioned thinking of them as minors.
Yes, that's another perspective. You can view them as being derived from a larger standard Toeplitz matrix, Sij, by essentially removing a finite number of rows and columns and maybe rearranging the first M ones. It's like making a few specific edits to that big grid.
Gotcha. Okay. So Tracy and Windham are deriving an asymptotic formula for these large minors, these perturbed matrices. Mm-hmm. What exactly does an asymptotic formula tell us, and why is that predictive power so important for these large minors?
Okay, so an asymptotic formula basically describes how something behaves as a variable heads towards infinity. In this case, it's the size of the matrices, N. As N gets really, really large, it gives you a powerful approximation. It simplifies things by showing the long-run trend, what the system tends towards.
So it avoids calculating everything for huge N.
Precisely. And what's really interesting here is the specific limit they find. It's for the ratio that NM plus ND TN phi.
Ah, the determinant of the Toeplitz-like one divided by the determinant of the standard Toeplitz one of size N.
Exactly. This ratio tells you precisely how those initial finite perturbations, those M rows and columns, affect the overall determinant in the long run. How much do those few tweaks matter when the system gets enormous?
That's clever. Okay. Now, this sounds like a tough problem, but didn't you mention they weren't the first ones to find this kind of result? There's another group?
That's right, and it's a really key point. Bumpadiaconis.
Yeah.
They actually got the same asymptotic formula before Tracy and Wyndham.
Same formula.
The same asymptotics, yes. But, and this is crucial, they used a completely different mathematical toolkit. They used the representation theory of the symmetric group.
Representation theory. Wow, okay. That sounds different. How does that relate to matrices?
It's quite abstract. Instead of direct matrix stuff, it looks at the problem through the lens of symmetry. How can you rearrange things, transform them, while keeping the core structure? It uses abstract algebra, mappings. It's a very different conceptual world from fiddling with matrix entries directly.
Compared to Tracy and Wyndham, who used...
They used what they call standard methods of Toeplitz theory. So, tools and techniques already established within that specific field of matrix analysis.
Okay, so this raises a big question, doesn't it? If Bumpadiaconis already found the answer, why did Tracy and Wyndham do it again using these different, maybe more standard methods? What's the value added?
Oh, it's hugely significant. Think about it. You have two completely separate branches of mathematics representation theory on one side, Toeplitz operator theory on the other, and they independently arrive at the exact same results.
It's like building the same structure with totally different blueprints and tools.
Exactly. It doesn't just confirm the answer. It confirms the underlying truth of the mathematics from multiple viewpoints. It gives you immense confidence in the result. Plus, the different approaches often illuminate different aspects of the problem. You learn more about the connections between these fields. Tracy and Wyndham even say the answers must be the same, even if they look different initially. It's a powerful statement.
Right, that makes sense. Okay, let's dive into Tracy and Wyndham's approach then. You said standard methods of Toeplitz theory. Where's the magic in their method? What key tools did they actually use?
Well, their approach hinges on a few powerful ideas. First, they assume the infinite Toeplitz matrix T-phi is invertible. That's important. And crucially, they assume the function phi can be factored. Specifically, phi, phi, phi plus phi. This is the famous Wiener-Hopf factorization.
Wiener-Hopf factorization. Okay, heard of that. What's the essence of it?
Right. So for anyone not familiar, phi plus and phi are special functions. Phi plus only has non-zero Fourier coefficients for non-negative indices, and phi only has them for non-positive indices. Essentially, you're splitting the original function phi into two parts with specific spectral properties. You could think of phi plus as capturing maybe the causal or forward-looking part of the system, and phi the anti-causal or backward-looking part.
Interesting split. So it decomposes the function based on time direction almost.
In some contexts, yeah, that's a helpful intuition. It's a really fundamental tool in analysis, pops up all over the place when dealing with operators and function spaces. Honestly, when I first really got Wiener-Hopf, it felt like unlocking something major. You start seeing its power everywhere.
Okay, so this factorization is central. What does their main result, their limit formula, actually look like? Can you give us a glimpse?
Sure. Their core result, it's formula one in their paper, gives the limit of that ratio we talked about. Det mx plus n,
yeah.
Det teta bay, as n goes to infinity. And remarkably, this limit is just the determinant of a finite mxm matrix.
Wow. Okay. An infinite limit becomes a finite determinant. What are the entries of that small matrix?
The entries involve those Fourier coefficients from the factorization.
Yep.
Specifically, the entry at row I, column j, is a sum.
Mm.
You sum up coefficient with index pi plus k mn times psi plus coefficient with index dash qj k plus m. And you sum this product for k from 1 to infinity.
An infinite sum for each entry. That sounds complicated again.
Ah, but here's the beauty. Because of how phi and phi plus are defined, remember, their coefficients are zero for certain indices. This infinite sum actually only has a finite number of non-zero terms.
Oh, because eventually the indices in the sum fall into the range where the coefficients are just zero?
Exactly. So what looks like an infinite calculation elegantly collapses into a finite sum for each entry. It gives you a precise, calculable, closed form result for the limit. It's a beautiful piece of mathematical simplification.
That is elegant. Okay, but math always has conditions, right?
Yeah.
What needs to be true for this neat formula to actually work? What are the non-negotiables?
Good question. A really key condition is what's called uniform invertibility, the standard Toeplitz matrices, TN phi.
Uniform invertibility meaning?
Means two things. First, TN phi has to be invertible for all sufficiently large n. And second, this is crucial, the norms of their inverses, TN phi 1, must stay bounded as n gets bigger and bigger.
Bounded norms. Why is that so important?
It basically ensures stability. If the norms of the inverses weren't bounded, they could explode as n increases. The inverse operation wouldn't be well behaved, the system wouldn't be stable in the limit, and their whole approach might break down. The limit might not even exist.
Okay, so we need these inverses to exist and not go wild. Is this a common condition? Or is it quite restrictive?
Actually, it holds pretty often in what you'd call normal cases. If the infinite Toeplitz operator, T phi, is invertible, this usually holds. For instance, if phi of phi has a continuous logarithm, which is a reasonably common property for functions and applications, then you get uniform invertibility. The known cases where it fails are apparently quite complex, suggesting it's a fairly robust condition.
Right. Now, you contrasted this earlier with another famous result, the Segu limit theorem.
Yes, it's important to distinguish them.
You mentioned Tracy and Wyndham's result holds without needing extra hypotheses that Segu's theorem requires. Can you expand on that? Why is that such an advantage?
Absolutely. So the strong Segu limit theorem gives you the asymptotics of the determinant debt TN phi itself. It looks like G and E phi involving these specific constants T and E. But to get that result, Sager's theorem often needs phi to be quite nice, maybe smooth, continuous logarithm, certain technical conditions like Holder continuity, maybe no zeros on the unit circle.
So stricter requirements on the function phi.
Right. What's really compelling about Tracy and Wyndham's formula for the ratio is that it holds without needing all those extra smoothness conditions. It just needs that uniform invertibility we discussed.
And why does that matter practically?
It means their formula works for a wider class of problems. Think about fields like quantum statistical mechanics or random matrix theory. Sometimes the functions phi you encounter there aren't perfectly well behaved. They might have jumps or kinks or zeros that would violate Seeger's strict conditions. Tracy and Wyndham's result gives you a reliable tool to calculate the limit of that ratio, even in these rougher scenarios. It pushes the boundary of what we can rigorously analyze, offering broader predictive power where Seeger's theorem might not directly apply to the determinant of this perturbed matrix.
That's a significant advantage. Okay, let's talk about the proof itself. Without getting lost in every single step, can you give us the flavor of their strategy? How did they actually get to this elegant formula? What was the clever move?
Certainly. The core strategy uses a pretty standard but powerful trick from linear algebra involving block matrices. You know, if you have a matrix M made of four blocks, say A, B, C, D, and if that bottom right block D is invertible, then the determinant of the whole thing M is D, D times D, A, B, D, 1, C.
Right, the sure complement formula, essentially.
Right, exactly. It lets you break down a big determinant calculation. So in their case, the big matrix M is their Toeplitz-like MM plus N. The block A is the MXM perturbed bit at the top left. D is the standard NXN Toeplitz matrix, TN chi at the bottom right.
Can B and C are the off-diagonal blocks connecting them?
Precisely. So the determinant they care about, DMM plus N, is DKNPM times the determinant of ABTN phi 1C. Their goal is then to figure out the limit of this term, ABTMOTTN phi, as N goes to infinity.
And that's where the uniform invertibility comes in again.
Critical, because uniform invertibility guarantees that as n gets large, the inverse of the finite matrix, Tn phi dash 1, actually converges nicely in a strong sense to the inverse of the infinite Toeplitz matrix, Ttm dash 1.
So they can swap the finite inverse for the infinite one in the limit.
That's the key simplification. It lets them focus on the limit of ABTn phi minus 1c, which is much more manageable than dealing with Tn phi 1 directly for large n.
So it really is this clever breakdown. You isolate the tricky part, use the limit to replace a finite inverse with an infinite one, and then analyze that simpler expression, like mathematical surgery almost.
That's a great way to think about it.
Yeah.
Then the final steps involve using known factorizations of T phi and its inverse, relating them back to that Wiener-Hof factorization, T phi and T phi plus. They do some careful index management, extending things to cover positive or negative integers as needed, and apply these factorizations. And when the dust settles, they show that the ij entry of that limiting expression ABT phi 1c is exactly the sum that appears in their final formula 1.
Wow, so it all ties back beautifully to that Wiener-Hof structure.
It does. It's a really elegant blend of linear algebra, operator theory, and asymptotic analysis.
Okay, so wrapping things up a bit, what's the big takeaway for us, for you listening in? We've taken quite a deep dive today into these Toeplitz-like determinants. We've seen how these complex beasts can actually yield surprisingly elegant asymptotic formulas, and we've seen the power of tools like Wiener-Hof factorization and these clever block matrix tricks.
And I think connecting it to the bigger picture, it really highlights something profound about mathematics itself, doesn't it? You have these totally distinct theoretical frameworks, representation theory versus Toeplitz theory, coming from different places, using different language, yet they converge on the same fundamental truth.
It really underscores the robustness of it all. Like you said, they had to get the same answer if the math is right.
Exactly. It's not just a coincidence. It reflects the internal consistency and interconnectedness of mathematics.
Yeah.
It's deeply satisfying, really.
Well, hopefully you listening found some fascinating nuggets in there and maybe gained a bit of a shortcut to being well-informed about this pretty specialized but very elegant corner of math.
And maybe it leaves you with a question to ponder. How often does this happen elsewhere? Maybe outside mathematics entirely. Different fields, different disciplines, perhaps independently discovering principles that are, at their core, the same thing.
Just expressed in vastly different languages or contexts.
Right. And what could we learn if we actively tried to compare those different perspectives?
Mm.
Just like comparing the bumped Iconis proof with the Tracy Whittem proof helps us understand the determinant problem more deeply.
That is a thought-provoking question to leave everyone with. Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and keep learning.